If those of you who've seen me on YouTube, all the years I've been coming to this joint, I've given so many hundreds of talks, we're in their thousands now. So I do enjoy it when somebody says, can you please talk about this or please talk about that? And so just beforehand, I was asked, can you please today something about young people? I said, no, I've forgotten what it's like. It's been such a long time ago. But nevertheless, for this evening, I will give a talk on the Buddhist way of bringing up kids. And actually, I'm an expert on bringing up kids because all the young monks in my monastery, they're all like kids. And even this one sitting next to me, I brought him up. I'm his monastic father, and he's a nice kid. But not only that, I remember the times I was a school teacher, and of course remember the times when I was growing up. And you know, there are some things which as a Buddhist monk, meditates, no psychology, been around a while, can give some assistance about, you know, how to bring up your children. But first of all, there was like a general question which many, many years I heard this question asked, and I heard the answer from this one monk, and I thought, what a wise question that is. Because it brings up a question which many of you may face, if it's not your children, your grandchildren. You know, should we bring them up as a Buddhist? Or what should we do with them with as far as their religion is concerned? Should we drag them to the temple? You know, yesterday I went to a funeral service of a very lovely man who passed away recently. Actually, I should have. He used to be a past vice president, you know, Ben Kiat. He passed away. But his granddaughter, Mei Li, she said, yeah, when I was 4 years of age, my granddad used to drag me to this temple here to listen to my talks. And I thought, oh my goodness, she's going to complain. She said, no, I love them. And I still remember some of the stories. And that's about 25 years ago. They haven't changed in 25 years. But it's wonderful to see that just bringing her to the temple just exposed her some nice teachings. But I'm not sure if she's a Buddhist or not, but I don't really care. Because one of the questions was, should we bring our children up to be Buddhists? And to me, growing up in the West, no, that's really a wrong thing to do. To force any religion, philosophy on your kids, you know, is pretty much sort of immoral. So what should we do then? Not even talk about religion or spirituality? And this monk said, no, that's really wrong also. You've got to give your kids some encouragement or some help. So he gave this beautiful answer. He said, really encourage your children to develop two qualities in life, honesty and questioning. Just that much. Because if you encourage their questioning, what you're doing, you're encouraging them to seek answers, to find wisdom, to develop the tools by which that one day they will discover the truth for themselves. So you're not telling the truth, you're giving them the encouragement to find out. And number two, encourage them to be honest. I don't mean just, you know, tell the truth to other people, but tell the truth to themselves. In other words, they will not stop at any sort of half-truth or half-baked idea when it doesn't really fit the facts, when it's not honest to their experience and understanding of life. So they said, if you encourage your children with those two qualities, you know, questioning and that form of honesty, he said, you know, your children will find their own truth. Yeah, you can bring them to the temple, you can take them to the church, you can encourage them to visit the mosque or whatever. But when they always question, then of course they will eventually find the answer. And to be honest, to be truthful as well. It reminded me of this story which somebody asked me a few days ago. I was over in East Malaysia. And it just comes up. It's an old story, but it's one of the really good ones. And it's about questioning, because here actually you're allowed to ask questions. You come up afterwards and you encourage questions. At the end of the talk, I always ask, are there any questions? Now, usually what happens is no one puts their hands up, but after the talk is finished, there's a whole line of people asking their questions. And great, we try and encourage questions, because that's part of what we are. But you know, I remember when I used to be a young man growing up in London, you weren't allowed to ask questions in a church. You know, you couldn't after the sermon put your hand up and say, excuse me. But on this occasion, someone did ask a question after a sermon in church. Because you may have heard this before. This is not a joke, actually, but it's a funny ending, but it's a really, really meaningful story, an anecdote. At the end of the sermon, he asked a question. It happened to be this new member of the congregation who was not only very wealthy, but was also a philosophy professor at university. And so when he put his hand up and said, I want to ask a question, the priest said, okay, you can ask, it's not usually done. And the question was this, he said, you've just taught from your Christian Bible that the only people who can go to heaven have to believe in Jesus. And he said, is that true? Because, said the professor, there have been these wonderful people, such as the Buddha, such as Socrates. He was a very wise and very virtuous man. Such as the Roman Emperor, Marcus Aurelius. If you've ever seen his contemplations of Marcus Aurelius, it's very inspiring stuff. You've got people even like new people, like, say, Mahatma Gandhi. He didn't believe in Jesus, he was a Hindu. So what happens to them? Do they have to go to hell? Now the priest, was a very smart guy. So he said, it's a really big question and I don't think we've got the time now to answer. I'll tell you next week in my sermon. It's one of the things I always do. If in doubt, procrastinate. So usually, as a priest, they work very hard on a Sunday. So Monday they have the day off. It's rest, relaxation day. And Tuesday he went into his study, got out all the books and tried to find an answer. And it was a really good question. He couldn't find an answer which would be suitable for a professor. So he rang up his mate, another sort of priest, much older than him. On Wednesday they made an appointment, had coffee and discussed it. And the priest said, look, this is too complicated for me too. You better go and see the archbishop. So on Thursday, went to see the archbishop. Thursday, the bishop. And on Thursday, went to see the bishop. The bishop said, this is something for the archbishop, not me. So on Friday, went to see the archbishop. And the archbishop said, actually, you should go and see the theologian. These professors who live in universities, they'll probably know the answer. So on Saturday, went to see the theologian. And the theologian gave him an answer. Couldn't understand a word of it. That's what theologians are like. Only other theologians can understand what they're saying. So there he was, Saturday night, without an answer. And the following day, he'd have to front up to this professor. So he didn't sleep well that night. In fact, he was just very restless. What was he going to say? So he got up very early in the morning. He did what he should have done to begin with. He went into his church early in the morning and started praying. And it was probably because he hadn't slept the night that he fell asleep at the altar. And as he was falling asleep, he had one of these dreams, these really vivid dreams. He was at a railway station, and he sort of knew where that train on that platform was headed for. But he asked, the station guy, said, that train over there, it wouldn't be going to heaven, would it? And the station guard said, yes. And seeing as you're a priest, you can go up there half price. So he got a half price ticket. And he got on the train, just like in dreams, like time is really weird. In no time at all, the train appeared on this platform. And he saw on the side of the platform the letters HEAVEN. It was heaven. He'd arrived. So he got outside so he could actually ask his questions. He searched around for a little while, and so soon he found this man in this white robe with a little donut on top of his head. And he said, excuse me, sir. He said, yes, how can I help you? He said, now, what's the name of this place? He said, it's heaven, welcome. He said, great. Now, I want to ask you two questions. He said, oh, of course, ask. He said, how long have you been up here? And he said, I've been up here hundreds of years, said this angel. He said, great, so you must know most people. Yeah, I know most people up here. How can I help you? What's question number two? He said, look, I want to know if these people are up here. First of all, there's this Indian guy, the Buddha. Is he up here? And he said, the Buddha? Never heard of the fellow. What about Socrates, this Greek guy? Very, very smart, very wise. He said, no, haven't heard of him either. What about Marcus Aurelius? No. What about Voltaire, this really funny guy? Voltaire is, you know, this playwright and philosopher. Said, no. What about Gandhi? Just a new arrival. Haven't heard of that name either, he said. And the priest was so satisfied. He'd have his answer. He'd got it right. The Bible was correct. So feeling self-satisfied, he went back to the station to get the train back. But he saw on another platform, there was another train. And he just wanted to make sure. He knew where the other train was going to. So he went to the station guard and said, that train over there, would it be going to a place called hell? He said, yes, that's where that one's going to. So he bought a return ticket. And he got on the train. And in no time at all, it arrived at this other station. And he saw on the outside this big sign saying H-E-L-L. But he saw some balloons tied to the station sign, which was a bit strange. And as soon as he got out, he didn't need to seek anybody. Someone came right up to him and gave him a big hug. Welcome! Thank you for coming. Is there anything we can get you to drink? How about a nice cup of tea? Or do you want some orange juice or apple juice? No, no, hold on a minute. What about a sandwich? You must be very tired. Sit down. The fellow was so kind and compassionate. He said, look, please, please, thank you so much for your kindness. But now, what is this place? It's hell. Welcome. Are you sure you don't want something to eat? How about a pizza? How about some fish and chips? We've got some really nice fish and chips down here, freshly fried. No, look, please, please. I just want to ask you two questions. How long have you been down here? I've been down here thousands of years, he said. Great, he said. So you know most people? Oh, yeah, I know everyone up here. Such nice people up here, you know. He said, look. Are there anybody down here called the Buddha? Oh, the Buddha. Such a wise and compassionate being. Oh, he's one of the most important people down here. So, what about Socrates? Oh, yeah. My goodness, his wisdom is so deep. Marcus Aurelius, great poet. Voltaire, such a funny guy. We love going to his plays. What about Gandhi? Oh, him, he's just come here. He's so well respected. He's so peaceful and kind. And the priest was actually quite happy. He said, look, that's what I always believed in, but there's something wrong. Because I always told that hell was a place of torment and torture where people were having a very tough time. But you seem so happy, and there's even balloons along the station. What's up here? And the hell being, whatever you call him, said, oh, well, yes, it used to be like that before the Buddha came down here. Now, that's not a Buddhist story, because the idea of Buddha being hell is that's a bit sort of heretical. But the meaning of that story is a brilliant meaning, because isn't it the people who make the place, not the place which makes the people? There's something that's really important there. Because I was talking to a Christian guy today, and I was saying, look, you know, the church is not the important thing. It's the people who come in the church. This center over here is architecture, or, you know, the buildings or whatever. Yeah, that's helpful. But the most important part of this center is the people who live in it and visit it. And the same as our monasteries. You know, years ago when we were first starting, people said, where's the monastery? Where's the monastery? What do you mean? This is the monastery. There's no buildings. Exactly. The trees, the forest, the space, the atmosphere, the kindness, the joy, the monks, the smiles on their face, the happiness on the nuns' faces. That's the monastery. It's the people, not the place. And I think that's such an important part of religion. Now, sometimes we have these huge cathedrals, these huge monstrous edifices, and there's something wrong there, because the people are far more important. You can't even touch the walls because they're painted by Michelangelo or something. There's something wrong there. This place is not just to be seen, it's to be touched, to be felt. People are always more important than things, and people make the place, not the place which makes the people. So if the Buddha did ever get reborn, which he can't, and if any good people did down to hell, they'd soon sort it out. It'll soon be peaceful and wonderful. People make the place. But the most important thing, I mentioned that story, was the questioning is really, really important. You know, I've just come back over from East Malaysia, from Sabah and Sarawak, and giving talks over there. And at the end of the talks, you know, sometimes for people you don't know, and these are sort of Chinese people over who came to my talks, sometimes they're too embarrassed to ask questions. So because of that, I always have to do this same old story to try and encourage questions from people. And it shows the importance of questioning and encouraging your kids to question. And this is actually a story from the Buddha Sutras. It's actually from the Chula Kamo Vibhanga Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya. And I say that because there's a couple of monks from Sri Lanka, and I just want to impress them that I know the sutras. And in that sutra, the Buddha was asked some questions on karma and rebirth, you know, part of the Buddha's teachings. And his first question was this. He said, why is it that some people are just wealthy and other people are just poor? And you might know this yourself. Some of you work so hard. You work, you start a little business, you struggle, you go to work, you try and save up, but then, you know, the money goes here, money goes there. It's just so hard, you know, to keep, you know, keep ahead of things. But other people, they just buy one lottery ticket and they win the first prize. You know, they start a business and it sort of, you know, goes gangbusters and makes millions. But they seem to just, money just comes to them. You know, and you work much harder than that. And so what did you do in your past life to be poor? And what do you have to do in this life to be wealthy so you can live, you know, at ease? What's the karmic cause for wealth and poverty? So the Buddha gave this answer. You can look it up yourself if you want. But it was such a good answer, he asked a second question. And that second question was, why is it that some people are born beautiful while other people are ugly? What karma did they do in their last life to be ugly? Now, of course, you may have noticed when I said that, I looked at the little table in front of me. And the reason was, you know, as I've said here before, that one day I was giving this story in Singapore. I remember it was Singapore. And I just happened to be looking at one girl when I mentioned the word ugly. My goodness, did she complain. Why did you mention the word ugly when you're looking at me, Ajahn Brahm? And here in Nolamara, it's even more dangerous if I just happen to be looking at a girl when I mention the word beautiful. She gets the wrong idea. Look, I'm a monk and I like being a monk, okay? So don't get any ideas. So the Buddha gave the answer, why? You know, you can be beautiful in your next life, and why some of you will be ugly in your next life. The karma behind that. So then he gave the next question, which is the important one. And the next question was, why are some people intelligent while others are stupid? You know, remember when you go into school? You know, there's some kids, they'll be playing around all day. When it comes to exams, they get top marks, get the ducks, and they hardly did any work. And others, they go to university, and they just play around all day, and they get first-class honours. Others, they just work so hard, extra tuition, you know, staying back, doing extra work, and still, you know, you struggle to get a pass. Why is that? You know, it can be so annoying, can't it? But unfortunately, I was one of those smart kids who didn't do any work and still got good grades. So I can't really sort of, emphasize with somebody. I was one of those pain in the necks, always playing around, but still got good marks at school and university. But what? There must be some karmic cause for that. What is the karmic cause for intelligence in your next life and the karmic cause for stupidity in your next life? And the answer the Buddha gave was this. He said, the karmic cause for stupidity in your next life is not asking questions in this life. It's a brilliant answer. Because what that really meant is when you ask questions, it means your mind is investigating, it's challenging, it just doesn't believe. It would always challenge, ask, find out the meaning, take it even deeper. So if you want your kid to be intelligent and you stop asking you questions, it means that you are actually stopping their intelligence, stopping their development. So one of the first important things, you know, with you, in life, always ask those questions. Ask the questions of life, ask the questions of yourself, ask the questions of Buddhism, because that's where you take it deeper and deeper and deeper. So that's actually why we encourage questioning, because it's the way to wisdom. And why, if you want your kid to understand, you know, meaning of life, religion, spirituality, or even just, you know, their what they want to do in life, please encourage those questions. They are vital. And also, the honesty is the other thing to encourage in children. Unfortunately, and I mentioned this here before, the way that we bring up children, we actually discourage honesty. It's discouraged. Why? Because sometimes when they tell the truth, they get into trouble. They say what's happened, and they get scolded by their parents. And soon the kids learn that it's more valuable, it's in their interest, they get on in life if they don't tell the truth. And that's one of the reasons when you are bringing up children, if you want to encourage honesty in them, you have to have this wonderful amnesty. And even tell your kids, if you tell the truth, you will never be punished or scolded, no matter what that truth is. And that's really, really, really important. That's what happens with the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. As long as they tell the truth, as long as they say what happened, there's no scolding, there's no sort of sense of, oh, you've been a bad monk. No, there's a sense of very good. You've opened up, told what you've been doing, how you've been feeling. No punishment, but now, once there's honesty there, there's a sharing of the problem. The next thing which happens is let's work out a solution so you never need to do this again. And that's what kids really need. They're trying to discovering a path in life, trying to understand what they should be doing. They make many mistakes, and when they make big mistakes, sometimes they need mummy and daddy to understand them. They want to open up to at least one person or two people in life to say exactly the mistakes they've made and be understood. They're still growing, they're learning, they're not perfect yet. And mummy and daddy to say, well, that's a very hurtful thing you've done, a terrible thing you've done, but, you know, let's understand it and let's go forward. Let's learn. Why did you do that? But when there's scolding, it means that you are cutting off your possibility of helping and assisting your kids in a time of real desperate need. And I was telling some of the monks a couple of days ago that because I've been here for over 28 years now, sort of teaching in this place, and many of these young people, they've grown up with me. And they saw me, you know, they first came to the temple, and they've seen me, and they've seen me now, and they've been 18, 20, 30 years, or not quite 30 years now. And they got to trust me so much, I'm like another grandparent for them. You know, not the grandfather, not the grandmother, the grand monk. And grand monk can be very helpful at times. So a couple of times, some of the kids have come up to me and said, look, Ajahn Brahm, you know, I'm pregnant. I'm afraid to tell my mum and dad. Will you tell them for me? Get me out of trouble. And, you know, I feel very honoured to be able to help out that way. Because, I know, your daughter's got themselves in big trouble, and unfortunately they're so afraid of what mum and daddy might say to them, so they need me as an intermediary. You should never really get to that point. Mummy and daddy should be so, sort of give them so much trust and love, they say, well, look, if you are in a big trouble, please come and tell us. We won't scold you. Because the kid says, look, I'm afraid what my mum and dad will think and do. I've really let them down. And that shows that mum and dad really haven't encouraged that honesty. Whether you can come and tell your mum and dad anything, and you will never be felt afraid to be honest to your mum and dad. So that's why be careful of punishing your kids. What it does, it means that they don't want to be honest to you anymore. They lie because they don't like being scolded. So it's a tough one, but I ask each one of you, if you've got a kid, please tell them, encourage them, look, you can tell me anything, son or daughter, anything at all, and as long as you're honest, you'll never be scolded or punished, because I'll be here to help you. If they get caught by the police with drugs or something, oh God, what will my dad say? Oh, obviously, I hope the dad would say, you made a mistake, but you're still my son now. No scolding, no punishment. Thank you for telling me now. How can we help? With that type of honesty, it means the kids, when they're growing up, they really do have a mother and a father who are there for them. And they're not afraid to tell their mum and dad anything. Because the mum and dad loves them enough. You're encouraging honesty and truthfulness in life. Also, the other thing which parents need to do to help their children is to encourage them. Because kids get so much, criticism in life. I don't know how many kids get depressed or have low self-esteem, feel bad about themselves. Maybe you've got low self-esteem as well, and you got that from when you were kids. And I remember being a kid, and I remember going with my mates, you know, was 17 years of age, and three of us walk. I remember this experience, one amongst many. We were walking down Fulham Palace Road, going up to Hammersmith for something or other, and there's a couple of girls passed by, and one of my mates said, yeah, I don't fancy yours. It was like an old joke we used to say. You know, in other words, you know, you're not going to sort of get any girl. You know, you're too ugly. Yeah, but look at you. You know, you've got bad breath. But look at you. You've got a fat bottom. And this was my friends. You know, we were criticizing each other because it was peer pressure. And that's the same with girls as well. My goodness, you know, your best friend, they criticize each other. You've got flat breasts. Yeah, I know, but, you know, you've got mousy face. Whatever it is, the amount of criticism which our kids hear from their friends, you'd be surprised. Now, I remember going once here in Perth, getting a bus, coming to this place, getting a bus on a Friday afternoon and sitting behind some schoolgirls on the way back from school and listening to what they said to each other. And just, you know, in the back, just overhearing their conversation, always criticizing one another. Now that's, you can maybe remember that from your school days. You know, the amount of little jibes which come into you. And when they get home, you know, go upstairs, do your homework, your grades aren't good enough. The amount of criticism you get from your parents is also very, very large. And then when they get to school, unless they're an A student, they get criticized by their teachers as well. Come on, work harder. And in fact, when I see just the amount of criticism which kids get, I really wonder why they survive or how they survive. And maybe that you can recall that from your childhood as well. I was fortunate to have a very loving, super loving father. You know, if I am compassionate and kind and a good monk now, much of that comes from my first teacher, my dad. And he was just so positive all the time. You know, he would never criticize. And I think I remember telling you why that happened. I diverged now, you know, to my father's upbringing. He came from the town of Liverpool before the Second World War. His father, my paternal grandfather, was a plumber. I only found this out by really pressing my father to tell me about my paternal grandfather, because he would never let me know. When I did get it out of him, the first words which my father said, and again, please excuse the language, but I need to say this to make it clear. My father said his father was a bastard. And that shook me. What do you mean, using such words as your own for your own father? And then he explained what his dad used to do. Every evening, come home drunk, get out his leather belt, and just whip any kid who was happened to be within reach, and then start to beat his wife, my father's mum. What my father said, though, was really amazing. He said when he was on the end of a beating, for no reason at all, just because his father was drunk, he made his vow, if ever I have kids, he said, I will never treat them like that. I will never hit them. And he never could. He didn't need to hit us to make us good people. This is the sort of thing which he said to me. I remember this once. He once told me, he said, never steal. He said, if you want something that bad that you're willing to steal and risk getting into big trouble for it, if you really want it something that bad, don't steal. Just tell me and I'll buy it for you, no matter what it is. He said, I don't want you to steal. If you really want something, just let me know, anything, and I'll buy it for you. And he was a very poor man. He was out of work a lot of the time. But what it told me, he said, he loved me so much that he would, and I know he would do that, he would beg, borrow, find some money from somewhere to get me something if I really needed it. And that had such an impact on me, I just couldn't steal anything. No way could I do that. When a person trusted me so much, that was another way of teaching, encouraging. It's a great thing if maybe I share that story with you, if you tell that to your kids. Look, kids or grandkids, never ever steal. If there's something you really, really want that much, you're willing to risk getting into big trouble for stealing it, let me know and I'll buy it for you no matter what it is. Because what that did to me, and I think what it'll do for most people, realizing there was some sort of love, some care there, that stealing was so bad, he wasn't punishing me to teach me stealing was bad, it was something much more powerful. That type of encouragement of a kid, not criticizing them, but getting to some other part of them and raising that part up, was very, very powerful for me. And I think it's powerful for others. So teach your kids to question and be honest, and you be honest to them. And be very careful to stop the criticizing and the blaming, because that is really what gets kids really down. They want someone. They haven't got their friends. They want their mum and dad as someone they can go to and tell anything to. And if they haven't got you, they'll come and tell me and bother me about I got in trouble, with the kids or with the school or something. So when you've got someone to go to who's honest, then it's a great resource for you. So someone who can understand you, understanding your learning life. So that's what a kid really needs. They need a huge amount of encouragement. And when I was a school teacher for 1 year, of course, that's who I was. That's how I learned my stuff. I was really encouraging those kids. And very, very rarely would I ever criticize them. You know that at the end of the year, you had to give a report to your kids. And all my reports were all positive, even the kid who came bottom of the class. I don't know if there's any school teachers here, there's a few school teachers, it's maybe not the right thing to do, but I just wrote out all the sort of the average words I could think, like good or fair or making progress or whatever. And I just assigned those labels at random to the kids. Because I thought, how can I judge these kids? And if I judge them bad, terrible, now, that's not going to help them at all. Giving them negative feedback will just be telling them they can't do math, which was my subject I was teaching. So instead of that, I was always trying to encourage them, whatever they could do. And because that was my sort of training in psychology as a Buddhist, even when I was a teacher, I found that actually worked. There's one experiment which I did with one kid in my class, in my math class. Because the teachers told me before, how these kids are done. And said, this kid is hopeless at maths, always comes bottom of the class. And I took that as a challenge. So this is one kid, bottom of the class in maths. So after I was teaching maybe two or three lessons a week in this class, every lesson, at the end of the lesson, I'd always go up to this kid. Do you understand that? I really sort of encouraged him. I gave him extra time. It was unfair, and I admit that, but this was my experiment. Extra time, encouragement, and after 1 year, in the end of the year exams, this is no exaggeration, he came first. Top of the class. Because I wanted to prove to myself, is it just because a kid can't do maths? Is it something genetic or something that, you just can't do these things? Or is it just hasn't had enough encouragement and confidence yet? And that's all I did. Build him up, give him confidence, extra time, explain things to him. And of course, you take him from the bottom to the top. And that taught me a lot about kids. That really what they need to do is encouragement. Not, you stupid kid, you can't do this. But actually encouragement, yes you can. Obama, yes we can. Nike, just do it. And I actually believe in that so much because that's what I do. That's how I've been teaching for years. Even teaching like monks in monastery, nuns, teaching you when you come to a retreat. People keep on asking me in Singapore, we're lay people, can we get jhanas? Can we become enlightened? My answer, yes, we can. And you know, it's amazing because I started teaching these deep meditations years ago, one of the first monastics to start teaching these to lay people. And some of the monks said, oh, you're wasting your time, Ajahn Brahm. You know, these lay people, they can't sort of get these jhanas with all their sort of attachments and living their life. And said, no, let's give it a try. And of course, many of you have. And it was amazing. Why? Because I said, yeah, it's possible. That's all you need. Tell your kids, yes, it's possible. Yes, you can. Never, ever please tell your kid that they're stupid. Because a lot of times, if you tell your kid they're stupid, they'll believe it. There's one person in the monastery, I better not say who it is. They're a brilliant monk, skilled or whatever they do, but they did terribly at school. And talking to him, the reason why was one day his grandfather took him aside, saw his school results so far and said, you're stupid. And he loved his grandfather so much, he believed it. He said from that moment on, sort of, he didn't do well at school at all. Everything else is brilliant. If his grandfather hadn't said that, he'd have been at university. He's a very smart monk. And I've seen many people like that. So what kids, to raise them up, just a lot of praise, a lot of encouragement. And then they'll love you to bits. And when they love you to bits, it's amazing what they'll do for you. However, there comes a time when you get to be teenagers when it's just almost the unwritten law at school not to admit you're listening to your mum and dad. And I say not to admit because they do. I know kids and they do listen to their mum and dad what they say, but they daren't admit it because it's not done. So you parents, if you've got a teenager, say to your teenager, tell them, and drop it. They do listen. They just got to process it and do it themselves. But certainly they do listen. But if you want even better results, remember, if you want to get your kids to do things, you have to use psychology. And psychology is always looking at their weak points, first of all, and working and leveraging their weak points. When they're a teenager and you want to get power over them, find out if your son has a girlfriend. Your girl has a boyfriend, because there you have the leverage. There's the couple that are not here this evening, they often always come to our monastery over in Perth, and he was telling me about his son. His son was at university, really good boy. But, you know, after a while, he had a girlfriend, staying out late at night, you know, going clubbing. And the grades were going down at school, at university. And he told him many times, come on, you can go out, but you must study. You know, spend some time on your books. It's important for your life. But he wouldn't pay any attention. So one evening, he told this story. He's a brilliant guy. He waited for his son and his girlfriend to come back, maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. He was waiting for them. And when the car came in, he went outside the house to greet them. And of course, the son was terrified. What's my dad doing at this time of the morning? Is he going to tell me off in front of my girlfriend and embarrass me? And he said, no, can you please come in, both of you? And he brought them in and gave them a cup of coffee. And he didn't talk to his son, he was just talking to his son's girlfriend. And he said, look, you know, you've been going out for a while, I don't know what the relationship is, but, you know, who knows, you know, you may take it further one day, and, you know, get engaged and get married. And because of that, I just wanted to let you know, talking to the girlfriend, know, his grades at university are going down. He's doing really badly. What? She said. He never told me that. He said, well, I thought I should tell you because I'm sure you don't want to marry a dummy. No. And when the girlfriend found out what was going on, from that time on, the girlfriend, you better come home. How are your grades? Are you doing your homework? And the girlfriend had far more power over him than a mother and dad would ever have. So his grades went up. Eventually, you know, he graduated and got a really, really good degree. And they got married. Ah, isn't that nice? See, it happens, of course, you know, you go out together, eventually, you know, you might marry that person. So if you've got sort of, you know, a daughter who's really misbehaving, find a boyfriend. If she hasn't got one yet, find a boyfriend for him, her, someone who's, you know, malleable, and then you've got all the leverage you want over your kids. That's their weak point, their peers. That's the thing. If you want to get sort of leverage over anybody, find out their weak points first of all. And once you have their weak points, you've got them under control. So that's another way of actually looking after your kids. But it's appraising which is the most important, because unfortunately there are many kids who get depressed. And why do they get depressed? You know, because they think they can never live up to mum's expectations. But we love you, son. We love you, daughter. But you don't show it with your words. All you show to your kids is like this almost like commandant of, you know, the home concentration camp. You know, you've got to be in at a certain time. You've got to get these grades. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. And please, at least as Buddhists, you know that just getting the high grades is not a passport to success and happiness in life. I mentioned this before, very clear research done in psychology. If you want to be successful in life, you have to be happy first. Happiness leads to success, not the other way around. If you think I'm going to be successful and then I'm going to be happy, that never comes. Happiness first, and then you're successful in life. So if your kids are happy, then they'll find success. So you want to find out just ways of, you know, just making sure your kids are happy in life and happy at home. And in order to get that happiness, a lot of praise is important, a lot of joy, giving them some trust. Because a lot of times if you don't give those kids the trust, they'll never learn how to sort of live up to that trust. And in the end, you know, they'll become sort of, you know, if you don't trust them, they don't learn that trust. They'll just come and just basically misbehave. There was a lady here, she lost her husband. He's a very, very close disciple. Her kids, she came up to me once and said they want to go to nightclub. They said, nightclub, you know, there's drugs in nightclub, alcohol. I said, look, you know, your kids, they're going to go to the nightclub anyway. So you might as well let them go. And then they go with your permission rather than going against your permission. And anyway, they're good kids. Trust them, for goodness sake. And of course, she did trust those kids. She followed my advice. And the kids had a wonderful life. They're doing really, really well in life nowadays. They didn't go do anything wrong. Please trust your kids. You've got to let them learn. And sometimes learn by getting hurt, trusting them if they make a mistake. And then, okay, you made a mistake, kid, but, you know, I'm still your mum, I'm still your dad. And by that, then they will actually learn. And they make mistakes. They feel bad about it. They know they made a mistake, but at least they don't think, oh, mum's going to kill me. No, mum's going to understand you. Because after all, look, I was visiting my brother some years ago. And I was talking to his kids, you know, my nephew and niece. And I was talking to all the bad things my brother used to do and I used to do. And my brother actually started to overhear. He said, shut up, don't tell them that. I'm trying to get them to be good kids. I said, no, because when they understand what you did, and then they make those same mistakes, they don't feel so bad about themselves. Not only that, they understand that's part of growing up. You do stupid things, you make big mistakes. You do all sorts of, you know, silly things when you grow up, when you're growing up. So I used to do silly things growing up. I'm just trying to think of another silly thing I did. I told you most of the stupid things which I've done in life. I made a bomb once with my best friend. We didn't make a bomb. It was out of a big tin can. I don't know what. My friend was really, really clever at chemistry. And so I supplied the can. He supplied the chemicals. We went to the local park. We lit it and ran away. And it went big bang. Oh, that was really exciting. Until we both got caught. They were in big trouble. So that's kids being kids, okay? Sometimes boys being boys, we have to do such things. I remember going to this funeral of a person and they were remembering him. There was a building site next to his house and he blew up the portable toilet. I don't know actually how he did it, but he was very clever, but he got into big trouble because of that. Kids being kids, okay. So what have each one of you done, which is, you know, stupid things when you were a kid? I'm sure you've done many, many, many things. So you know, kids are being kids, so they need that life, they need to grow up, they need to make mistakes, and they need mummy and daddy to come along and say, yeah, we still love you, you made a mistake, but you know, next time don't go blowing things up. You know, sometimes you might blow your hand off or whatever, okay, but you know, well done, it was a big bang, you must be good at chemistry in the future. That's what really kids want. They want a parent who really loves them and understands them and understands the pressures they are in life. They get in life, and if they have that happiness, they'll be successful in life, like all people are. And just academic success is not the key to success in life. How many famous people didn't do well at university? And look at me, I did well at university, and look where I ended up, really poor. No money, no family, no house, no assets. But anyway, happiness is more important. So if you can encourage your kids to be happy rather than do good at school, make their happiness first of all, most important. It doesn't matter if you're not doing good at school. Are you happy? It doesn't matter if you're getting the high results. Are you really happy at school? Have you got lots of good friends? Are you really happy in life? And if your kids are happy in life, then they will do well. Again, I'm just doing anecdotes. There's one of the single mothers, a very old disciple of our monastery. She was one of the first disciples. She was always bringing dana to the first monks, you know, Ajahn Jacquara and myself. And whenever we're doing any building work, she'll come up and help. I remember the first building we did down at Bodhinyana Monastery, the ablution block. And you know, very stupid builders at that time, we built it on solid rock. And we tried to sort of break the rock up, you know, to put places for the plumbing. And there she was, you know, this 30, 40-year-old mother with a pickaxe attacking this rock. She was such a tough lady. And she had four children. And none of them did well at school. But they're brilliant kids in life. And they still come and see me from time to time. And every time they come, I'm just so impressed how well they've done in life. And one of those kids, you may get to know who he is, but I'm trying to sort of keep these stories anonymous. He is the head chef at Scotch College. And about a year ago, sort of he entered Iron Chef competition on TV. And apparently he's the only person ever to have won it. And I knew he'd do that because the way he was brought up, I went to see his mother when she was just before she was dying in her home, and she had this big queen bed. I've never seen a bed that big. You know, you had to squeeze past it to get in the room. It took, you know, 80% of the room. And I asked, this was about how many years ago? About 15 years ago now. They said, what have you got such a big bed for? It's so for my son. So when he brings his girlfriend home, he's got somewhere to stay with her. And I was really shocked. You know, he's only a 17-year-old son. He said, no, he's going to do that anyway. So in the home, give him a good bed. And that was this boy who won Iron Chef. Brilliant sort of motherhood. Because he understood her kids. And said, okay, if you're a girl, you know, quite likely they're going to have sex before marriage. So make sure that, you know, understand that, accept that. And just make sure they've got the protection and say that mum and dad are here. You know, if anything goes wrong, you know, you don't have to be embarrassed. Just tell your mum what's happened. I won't criticize you. I won't shun you. I won't be ashamed of you because, you know, in my community, you're not supposed to do that. No, please never make your children feel ashamed. Or don't be ashamed of your children for whatever they do. So that type of love and acceptance is a beautiful way of bringing up your kids. And then if you bring up your kids, I really do say that's the Buddhist way, a compassionate way. The door of my heart is open to you, son, daughter, no matter what you ever do in life. I'm your dad. That's what my father said to me. I'm your dad no matter what you do. I am your dad. I will always love you no matter what you do. And that really inspired me. I could talk to my father about anything. And I wasn't afraid of him. Because he was afraid of his father, who would beat him mercilessly for no reason. And he turned completely the opposite direction. So I am going to love my son unconditionally. And with that unconditional love, you know, I could go up to him and say anything. And he would understand. Because he was a kid himself. And he understood that what I really needed in life was support. Sometimes I go and ask him for advice. I remember asking for advice about how to find a girlfriend. I remember the advice he said. This is the sort of guy he was. He said, look, if a girl looks at you once, you don't know, but if she looks at you again, she likes you. Go for it. And that's what my father told me when I was about 14. That's why I love that guy to bits. He understood what I was interested in. So a little bit of fatherly advice like that instead, you know. Now just stay home and do your studies all the time. So that was actually, you know, how I understand as a monk to bring up your kids. And also that the kids need that, you know, that sense of self-respect, you know, the identity in their life. This is who they are. Obviously they get that first of all from their parents. They're the son and daughter of you, of mum and dad. They're part of that family. That family is loving, nurturing, a place where they can come home to and feel accepted. This is their place. This is their mum, their dad, who loves them and can understand them. If you scold them, you're not understanding them. The same way, you know, how many times have people scolded you? And what do you really feel at that time? They haven't really understood. All the pressures and difficulties, the situation I was in, why I did that. You know, a lot of times scolding means you don't understand. Why did you do that? Understand, first of all. Understand the pressures kids are in. Understand the pressures you are in. Understand the pressures the monks are in sometimes. You know, why we can't always come to your house to do a dana. Why we can't always sort of, you know, speak to you in the evening, you know, when you come here with a problem. You know, we're under pressure too. So understand. When you understand, there's no more criticism and scolding. A lot of times, if people understood the difficulties and pressures and circumstances we were in, we would get angry far less. We'd criticize far less. And we'd also feel less guilty. Basically, it was the best we could do at the time. But also, if you really love your kid very much, then maybe, you know, you won't get in this situation. Because I always tell a joke, and this is the kids' joke about how to bring up kids' joke for this evening, because there's this one kid. Oh, he was always having a hard time getting money from his parents, you know, for pocket money. So he talked about it with his friend. His friend said, look, I've got this amazing trick. It works every time. So he told him the trick. And that evening, when he came home from school, he went up to his sister. He looked her in the eye, and he told his sister, I know your little secret. He was making it up. He didn't know anything. But his sister didn't know. She said, oh my God, you don't, do you? He said. And sister said, how much? He said, $20. So his sister gave him $20. But don't tell mum and dad. Okay, I won't tell mum and dad. He said, it works. So you can go out to anybody and say, I know your little secret. And they get so embarrassed. How much? $20. So it worked. So it worked so well, the next day, he tried it on his mum. He went out to his mum and said, Mummy, I heard at school about your little secret. You didn't. Please don't tell Daddy. $50, Mum. So he gave $50 to his kid. And of course, on the weekend,
went up to Daddy.
Found Daddy alone and said, Daddy, I know your little secret too. Oh my God, who told you? We know everything at school. The sons of other people and daughters, you know, we talk. Oh my God, please don't tell Mummy. $100. And so his father handed over $100. And thinking somebody else, on a Monday morning, just on the way to school, he saw the milkman. So he went up to the milkman who delivered milk and said, Milkman, I know your little secret. And the milkman put down the milk and said, Son. Okay, that's a little funny story. I don't know why it's always the milkman who gets into trouble. But no, you don't need to do that for your kids. It's great, actually, for, you know, my father. Yeah, he was very poor, so he did give me some pocket money. You know the way he gave us pocket money? Just anecdotes now. He'd always love to spend time with us. So where we got our pocket money from, we used to play little games of cards, you know, for money. You know, it was gambling, but he would always lose. He'd always lose on purpose. Because, you know, I know from my brother and I, that's the way we get our pocket money. We'd have to spend an hour or two with our dad, you know, playing cards. And we'd always win. He'd always lose every time. And we'd love that because we knew it was only fun and games. It wasn't serious. And, you know, he always lost on purpose because that was the way he'd give his kids pocket money. But we'd have to spend an hour or two of our time with him as well. And I love those occasions. So it wasn't just, okay, here's, you know, $10 or $20. It was actually spending time with our dad. And then we got the money. That's a beautiful thing to do. And, you know, the money wasn't that important. It was important to me as a kid, but what was really important was actually spending time with your mum and dad. And that's the other thing. If you want to bring up your kids and you want to make them happy, please find the time to spend with them. Because that's the most important thing in the world, bringing up kids. They don't bring themselves up. You bring them up. And that takes a lot of investment, not of money, but of time. And you can do it if you want to. Sometimes it means taking time off work because the kids are more important. And I can't go past the other famous story. This will be the last story because I'm getting late. The last story, and again, I love telling this story overseas. I told this once it was over in Indonesia. I think it was in Sulawesi, in a small town. And I told this story at actually a press conference, and there was this Muslim girl. She was a journalist. And when I told her story, she burst out crying. She wept her eyes out. I found out afterwards because it was her story. It was who she was. She was a single mother. And she wasn't spending enough time with her son. Because this story was the one about the father who came home late at night. It's a golden oldie. Came home late in the afternoon. His son was waiting for his daddy to come home from work. Son was about 6 years of age. And as the father came in the door, the son said, Daddy, welcome home. How much do you earn at work? And his father said, Look, none of your business. I'm tired. You're only six. And the six-year-old said, But Daddy, how many dollars do you earn every hour at work? Look, I've told you, be quiet. But Daddy, how much do you earn? Oh, I've told you three times. Enough. Go to your room. Because you come home tired from work. You know, you don't want to be asked stupid questions from your kid. And he was so angry, he sent his kid up to his room. And so his kid marched up to the room and locked the door. He'd been grounded. And after Daddy had a cup of tea and rested a little bit, he felt so guilty at sort of scolding his six-year-old. So feeling guilty, he went up to his son's room, opened the door, went in and said, Look, I'm sorry, son, I was tired. A very busy day at work, and I don't know why you want to know these things, but I earn $20 an hour at work. And his son smiled and said, Thank you, Daddy. Now, can I borrow $10, please? And if you're feeling guilty, you've been scolded your son for nothing, and he asked for $10, you know, he couldn't scold his son again. So he just gritted his teeth, got out his wallet, and gave out a $10 note to his son. Thank you, Daddy, said the son. And then the son reached under the pillow to get 10 more dollars in coins, counted out a full 20, handed it to his father and said, Now, Daddy, here's $20. Can I please have 1 hour of your time? And I remember telling the story, and this girl wept. She was working so hard, trying to get a good life and education for her son. But she realized what her son really needed was her time. So if you really want to bring up kids, please remember that key story. Otherwise your son, your daughter, may end up doing that to you, giving you $10, $20, $30. I don't know how much you earn. Please, Mummy, can I have 1 hour of your time, please? It's a brilliant little anecdote. So please give your kids that time. My father used to give me that time, my mother too. Maybe they had more time in those days. Maybe because he was sick, he had more time. But I value those times. He wasn't rich. We didn't have a wealthy home. But it was a beautiful, loving home. And that way, you can bring up kids in a beautiful, loving way. So those are some little anecdotes of how to bring up your kids, teenagers as well. The most important thing, questioning, honesty, and to encourage honesty, amnesty to mum and dad. Whatever you say, son, daughter, you would never be punished. I never scold you. Even if you come and tell me that you know that you are a multi-murderer, you are the Claremont killer, I don't care what you say. You know, you're my son, you're my daughter, we'll always love you. Isn't it wonderful to have someone you can actually say such things to? That should be your mum or your dad. That certainly was my dad. I feel so privileged to have such a good Buddhist upbringing from someone who's an atheist. Thank you, Dad. Okay, so I've gone over time again, 9:03, but please, if there are any questions, please, if you'd like to ask them now. And remember, if you really do want to be intelligent in your next life, this is your opportunity. Are there any questions? Questions first? Yeah, go on, from another teacher. Okay, yeah. Okay, you're asking the question for the tape that in modern day, the teenagers especially have so much stimulation that they don't really have so much time to really contemplate. And if you haven't built up that relationship in the early days, it's very difficult to bring it back when they're in the teenage years. And how can you compete, you know, with that stimulation? Now, a lot of times, yeah, the kids will be very busy, but a lot of times people have told me that what they really want is mum and dad to be there. And sometimes it has to be there on their schedule, you know, when they're ready to talk, when they have their time, because they are, as you say, very busy. And mum and dad are very busy as well. But I really think it should be mum and dad's job to find the time and to be there, you know, when they do really need the time just to talk with you. To be with you. So that's why, you know, to say just any time when you really need me, please come. I'll take the day off or whatever. Because that's the most important thing in life, you know, with your family. At the funeral I went to yesterday, all the family were there and they were praising their patriarch of the family because he said to them, family was number one. Job, career was number two. But the family was always the first, and he'd always stop everything, you know, if a family needed him. And that's why he was so loved. So same with you, the family are much more important than career or money. So if that's your kids, yeah, they are very busy, but they do get in trouble. They do have difficulties and their peers can't help them. They can't help themselves, and that's where mum and dad, you know, we are there for you. When the call comes, I'm there for you. Does that make any sense? Yeah, good. Of course, yeah. The kids, it's their schedule, they've got their sort of... But the thing is, they don't want to associate with mum and dad doing stupid, uncool things. But they do want you there, you know, when they really do need your wisdom and your kindness and you just love. And sometimes that's all you need. Now, have a great time. You know, here's an extra $10 or $100, wherever you're going. Oh, thanks, Dad. Little things. I mean, you know what your kids really need. Give them that love, that kindness, appreciation. Have a great time. And that really actually really works. They really love you for that. I think you all remember your grandparents. Somebody was saying today, the grandparents, you know, they will give you things that mum and dad will never give you because their love is more unconditional. They don't have to be the disciplinarian and tell you what to do. I think if more parents were more like grandparents, I think the children will love them to bits even much more. Please don't be too much of a disciplinarian. Be much more of a lover, someone who trusts their kids. You make mistakes, but please, we trust you enough to do the right thing. I don't know, that's perhaps a Buddhist way. The Buddha always said, everybody fears the rod, put aside the rod. Teach with compassion rather than through fear. And of course, you know, for people up here, you know, you're mature enough now, you don't want to be sort of controlled by fear in this country of Australia. You know, you want to be trusted, respected, and more people do the right thing if they're respected rather than just through fear. Compassion is stronger than force. Okay, but that's a Buddhist way. You may disagree, but you're most welcome to disagree because here you're supposed to question and be honest and not just to follow blindly. So thank you for listening this evening to the talk.